Oh, thank you very much, Tudor. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. I've known Jerry for a long time. He was a great guy. We did so much math together. Those of you who were here on Wednesday heard the testimonials to him. The tragedy is he had so much math left. There is no question he could have gone on for a long time. But unfortunately, we are his colleagues, students, co-authors, friends, and we're here to celebrate his gift that he did give to us when he was with us. As I mentioned, I first met Jerry as a graduate student in Princeton. Since then, I re-met him. We were both graduate students there. Then we both went on to UC Berkeley as lecturers. We met again in Berkeley, as I mentioned, in the photocopy room in Evans Hall. And that's going to come up in a minute. I'll show you why. But we then went on to write 29 papers together over a period of 10 years. And already this is outdated because Jerry keeps writing more papers. There's over 400 now. So that percentage is much lower. So I just wanted to, anyway, so we started in 1971 with our first paper together. And we just continued on. And we finally finished up in 1980. And we probably would have gone on a lot longer, but he moved down to Caltech shortly thereafter. And that was our last paper together. So let me just give a couple of slides just there. Okay, so well, let me start here. So Allison showed you this slide. And there's the famous Einstein T-shirt, but it, as I mentioned, it does not come from across the street. I actually gave him that T-shirt. This was after a race in Beta Breakers in San Francisco, and we were invited to a little social gathering after, and we went, and it was a great time. And then here's another one. Oops, sorry. Let's go back. So that's us just after the race. I think Nancy, Jerry's wife, took that picture, but Allison and I were not quite sure. Then here we were. We went to several conferences together, just enjoying each other, mathematical conversations. Checkers were in there, obviously. So times changed a little bit. In 1968, Jerry went to Berkeley. This is a this picture was taken by George Bergman, and who was a okay. This was outside Evans Hall, and that's me. We've changed a bit, obviously. Jerry was off talking to a student. I remember this distinctly. That street scene, I mean, there it is, that same street. It was just sort of uncanny 4 years later. Of course, this is Ralph Abraham. I didn't know where this was. This appeared in the notices article, and then Allison brought this picture up too, and apparently it was taken at their house in Berkeley, but I don't remember which. She didn't know the date, so that's too bad. So I do want to just show you one thing. So after I talked about that, the meeting him again in Berkeley after at the photocopy machine. So I talked about that on Wednesday. Yesterday, in my email, someone had seen this thing stream live, and they sent me a clip. So yeah, I have to play this clip because it's just uncanny. Apparently, and I didn't remember this, Yao met me at the photocopy machine in Berkeley. And I told Yao that physics, topology and curvature could be very useful in the study of physics. And this was when Yao was a graduate student. And then recently he's gone around the world giving a lecture on applications of mathematics to physics. And, oh, wait, Pardon me? Wait, I have a low-tech solution.
I was interested in doing this subject when I was a first-year graduate student. And in fact, I found some interesting statements during the first few months. So while I was photocopying those notes in the copying room in Berkeley, I ran into Arthur Fisher. He was a junior postdoc at the time in Berkeley. He was very interested in what I wrote in those notes, although I was just a beginning graduate student. But then he got extremely fascinated that it's possible to relate curvature to topology in a very precise manner. And he insists that it should be useful for physics. But this comment has been always staying with me, that the link between curvature and topology would be useful for physical world.
So I think there's 2 points there. The power of the internet, I probably never should have left the photocopy. I should have just stayed there for my whole career as giving advice. At Berkeley? It's the place to be. So as I say here in the slide, forget the water cooler, just hang out at the Berkeley photocopy machine in the mailroom for the latest ideas. Okay, so having said that, we can start the little more serious, quote, serious scientific talk. Jerry and I did a lot of things. We started out in relativity. We branched out to Riemannian geometry. And then we branched out again to partial differential equations. Now, when I say branched out, what I mean is that one thing led to another. That's one of the main themes that he and I had in our work together. Something would come up, something else would come up related, we'd move on to that, and it was just continuously like that for 10 years. I don't want to get into a laundry list of the main topics. Let me just mention a couple that, and I'm going to talk about a couple here just to, this is sort of going to be like a retrospective talk to show you how one thing led to another, how we started out using general relativity, how that led to an understanding of geometrization of symplectic reduction, and how that led to first-order partial differential equations for general relativity, how that led to linearization stability questions. So it just went on and on and on. Here's a little list. The thing we started out with was the Arnouet, Deser, and Misner formulation of Einstein's empty space equations. That Jerry had just come from his thesis, which was on singular Hamiltonian systems, infinite dimensional Hamiltonian systems. I had just come from my thesis on the theory of superspace and general relativity, which was an infinite dimensional phase space. It was like a marriage made in heaven. We were talking to each other. We started talking about these topics, and our first paper together was the one on geometrizing Einstein's Hamiltonian formulation of relativity. More work in relativity about the existence and uniqueness theorems. We used first-order quasi-linear symmetric hyperbolic systems. This was completely unheard of as an application of those systems. Everything had been strictly hyperbolic second-order equations. Choquet-Brouard and Lichnerowicz were responsible for those results. This simplified things quite a bit. The system, the literature on first-order symmetric hyperbolic systems was quite large. In fact, it was already a topic in graduate courses. In fact, I was teaching a graduate course in Berkeley in PDE, and I was using Courant-Hilbert, and in Courant-Hilbert they have, just in the textbook, first-order symmetric hyperbolic systems. And you just keep staring at that, And eventually you say, well, why can't relativity be put into this form? And it turned out it could be. I'll talk a little more about that later, if there is a later. I guess there's always a later. Will I be in it? okay, then the other theme that we had was ideas in Riemannian geometry. Here, I think the main idea was that we thought of the scale, the curvature tensors on Riemannian manifolds, not as tensors. That, I think, was our main idea. We thought of it as a functional on metrics mapping into other spaces. And if you just take that one idea, that the scalar curvature, the Ricci curvature, the Einstein tensor, the sectional curvature, if you think of these not as tensors but as functionals, then what do? Well, if you have a function, there's only one thing to do: take its derivative. So we started just wildly taking derivatives to find, well, we actually did have a better plan than that. But it came down to just taking the derivatives and trying to see what kind of information we can get out of that. And I'm going to talk a little about what we actually accomplished by doing that. And then the last main theme is nonlinear partial differential equations. Well, this was the furthest thing from my mind, quite frankly. But again, everything was application driven, which, I mean, I remember that well. It wasn't like we said, oh, let's do nonlinear partial differential equations. I mean, that would never happen. It was, we need nonlinear partial differential equations to do general relativity. How should we handle it? And then once we knew what kind of system we needed, we'd see, oh, well, there's a lot of deficits there. The results are not very sharp. In fact, if you look in Courant-Hilbert, they say things like everything is of sufficient differentiability. Just make assumptions about sufficient differentiability. So we needed to have, in that time, there was not a lot about specific HS. There's not a lot. Get it on for the laser in my eye. There's not a lot about what the sharp hypotheses should be. So we had to figure that out, which we did. Okay, so it all starts here. Actually, this was the first thing that we actually looked at: the Arnoued desert and Lisner. Let's just look at the coordinate formulation of general relativity. Now, one question is, why do you want to put relativity into a Hamiltonian form? Because, after all, relativity really is quite nice just the way it is. In fact, the Hamiltonian approach to relativity definitely has its detractors. In fact, I remember Professor Taub mentioned to me, we said, well, Arthur, you know, Einstein really got it right. And I knew that wasn't going to be good. because he said, look, it's 10 equations, it's reach G equals zero. You're not going to improve on that. Why go from that to, let's look at what the Arnoued desert evolution form is, to this? I mean, let's face it, which is more elegant? So why waste everyone's time with a Hamiltonian formulation? Well, the answer is, that's a good question, but the other answer is that you need a Hamiltonian formulation if you want to quantize relativity, of course. No one's ever been able to quantize a covariant Lagrangian theory yet, although that may be the way to go, frankly. But in any event, so this is the coordinate form after you do the Euler-Lagrange equations of the Hamiltonian I had on the previous slide. Now, fortunately, this formulation has had a lot of work. This whole program was started by Dirac. Bergman made large contributions. Arnoued desert and Misner made contributions. And they actually put things into more or less the final form, which is, these are the evolution equations. Now, the evolution equations are not normally written down, but I did want to write them down just to show you how unpleasant looking they are. But fortunately, they do have an incredible structure. And DeWitt actually recognized that a lot of these terms are easily explainable by putting a suitable metric called the DeWitt metric on the space of Riemannian metrics and looking at the geodesic flow of that. And in fact, all of these algebraic terms, this one and this one, that are algebraic in G and pi, that is, they don't involve any derivatives, any spatial derivatives of G and pi, these terms are, this is the spray of the DeWitt metric. This term here that involves the Ricci tensor and the scalar curvature tensor, these terms are the forcing term. So these terms here can be thought of as a forced geodesic flow on the space of Riemannian metrics. So this is, DeWitt already knew this in the late 1960s. This term involving the Hessian of the Laplace function and the Laplacian of the Laplace function are sort of the complicated terms. These come about because as you evolve in the space-time, you don't necessarily have to take a flat hypersurface. You can take what Wheeler calls the many-fingered hypersurface, where the hypersurface gets pushed up in different parts in different ways. And then lastly, we have these terms here, and we have these terms here, and that Y should be an X, I apologize. Now, these terms, any geometer would recognize is just the lead derivative of the metric with respect to G. So that's a good thing. Unfortunately, down here, it's looking like a lead derivative, but when you take this covariant divergence of this tensor product, you get pi ij partial A, covariant A in the direction of A, and then you get this other sort of term, divergence of A. So right away, it's not actually the lead derivative of pi, which is sort of a problem. And I remember thinking that I really wanted it to be the lead derivative of pi. And I remember thinking, boy, I would really be happy if this were the lead derivative of pi. But unfortunately, it had that divergence term. So anyway, I was just going around worrying about that, thinking something's fishy. It could be Arnoit, Deser, and Misner equations be wrong. That would be highly unlikely. So I sort of just was eating dinner one day at Princeton Graduate School, and I just realized, well, wait a minute. It's not the lead derivative of pi, because what is pi? Pi is not a tensor. Pi is a tensor density. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me that if you take the lead derivative of tensor density, there is an extra term. That's the extra term. This is the lead derivative of pi. Now, okay, this may seem like a not too big of an observation, but what that means is that the equations can now be written in this very, at least these terms here, the lead derivative of g, the lead derivative of pi, the fact that these are lead derivatives explains completely the group of diffeomorphisms of the spatial group of diffeomorphisms acting on the phase space. And you'll see how that comes up in a minute. So this is sort of like the geometrization of the Arnoit, Deser, and Misner equations using the Dirac observations and then using the fact that these are just lead derivative terms. So let me just put that there. And then let me just point out that once you recognize that fact, you can then actually see that the entire system of ADM equations can be written in this very succinct form, where phi is the constraint functional. As I said, one of the main themes was instead of thinking of these things as just functions of g and pi equal to zero, think of them as functions of g and pi as maps. And if you do that, you can take the derivative, and then you can take, this is the L2 adjoint, and it's the natural L2 adjoint, which means that there's no metric involved. If you have an adjoint from one linear space to another, there's a natural adjoint that doesn't involve any Hilbert space structure, just involves the Banach space structure. And the curious thing about using this L2 adjoint is that if you then compare it with what classical physicists do with functional variation, that's exactly what they do. Their L2 adjoint is exactly the functional derivative of this functional phi. So, make a long story short, ADM can be put into this form. Now, since we're talking about the legacy, obviously, I just want to this went on to a lot of other work. Judy Arms then went on to extend this to Yang Mills and electromagnetism. Mark Otey, Phil Yaskin, Richard Montgomery, Jim Eisenberg, Chernitsky, I guess that's all of Ginzy, I hope, and Jerry Marsden, of course. David Bao? Okay, thank you. Went on to extend this to some to cover all general field theories. And as Mark told us, we're within 15% of that happening. So, okay. So anyway, let's just move on. Now, the important thing also is that that formulation has a lot of consequences. For one thing, I always like to say that this is Wheeler's dream. Wheeler's dream was that the evolution equations, those messy equations that we had sitting up there before, are not important. What's important are the constraints. And of the constraints, the most important one is the Hamiltonian. So let's just go, and this is why this equation is a fulfillment, at least in some sense, of Wheeler's dream. Because you see here, the only thing that comes into play is this functional phi, which is basically the Hamiltonian and momentum constraint. So in this sense, that those equations are generated by the constraints. So the algorithm that he had in mind was that the evolution equations are generated by the constraint equations. And this sort of explicitly shows that that is happening, at least for these sets of equations. And as we showed for a more limited case, and has been shown more generally by the Ginzy group, is that that actually seems to be a universal feature of Hamiltonian systems that come from covariant, that are deduced from covariant Lagrangian systems. Okay. Now, the other important feature that comes about is that one can look at... the constraint sets themselves. And the nice thing about doing that is that and this goes on to another theme that keeps occurring in our work. What's the structure of various subsets of spaces of metrics and momenta, things like that? And the answer is it depends. Unfortunately, these things are not manifolds. C delta is not a manifold, and CH is not a manifold, and the interception is not a manifold. So that was sort of unexpected also. However, by using the nonlinear functional analysis, we were very specific about why these things were not manifolds and what you could do about it. For example, C delta is not a manifold when G and pi have any common killing vector fields. And CH is not a manifold if G is flat and pi is zero. And lastly, the intersection is not a manifold it is a manifold if the other two are manifolds and the trace of pi is a constant times the volume element. So I mean, okay. So in any event, So we explained when these subsets are manifolds. So I just wanted to point that out. So that was another general theme that kept occurring here. Now, let me go on to see how one thing led to another. See, we didn't expect... Okay, so we geometrized relativity in that adjoint formulation, but it turned out that at the same time, Jerry was doing the classic work with Alan Weinstein on symplectic reduction. And we didn't realize, but the... We didn't realize, but the work that we were doing is actually very closely related to that. Let me show you that, accompanied by this. Now, I have to also say that what was not mentioned was the incredible visualization aspect that Jerry had. He could view things and come back with these. This is a picture that he did, a spectacular picture. Let me just talk about this for a couple of minutes because it just shows some. Let me blow that up. Or can you see that okay? Or, there, if you have a group acting on a symplectic manifold, or even more generally, if you have a constraint set that's invariant under a group action, there's naturally occurring two splittings. There's the splitting of the group, because you have the orbits of the group, and you have the orthogonal to the group. So you have two splittings because of the group action. And if you have a constraint submanifold, you have things tangent to the constraint submanifold, and you have things perpendicular to the constraint submanifold. So you have a splitting of the you have another splitting. So you have these two L2 orthogonal splittings. Suppose you intersect them, and that they're compatible. And by compatible means that the orbits all lie within the constraint submanifold. So if you intersect these two splittings, you will end up with a splitting which has three parts in it. And the three parts are this decomposition here. And more generally, it turns out to be a little more complicated decomposition. Well, it's the same thing. This is the case in relativity. This is the case in a general setting. So let's just look at this picture for a minute. We start off with a given G and pi. We have the constraint space, and we have perpendicular to the constraint space, which is this plane. And then we have the orbit, and we have perpendicular to the orbit. So these three parts are the following. We have, let's just look here. Kernel of d phi. Kernel of d phi. Phi is the constraint map or the momentum map. So the kernel of that are the infinitesimal directions which preserve the constraints. Then the its perpendicular part is the range of the adjoint, which is this piece. So this piece is preserves the constraints. This piece is perpendicular to the constraints. This piece preserves the group action, and this piece is perpendicular to the group action. Now, the part that's perpendicular to the constraints is non-physical, because the physics involves the constraints always being preserved. So this is non-physical. The part that's in the direction of the group action is also in the constraint subset. So that is physical, but it's a trivial physical piece because it's just an equivalent configuration. It's like when you have a ball and you want to look at all its configurations. If you rotate it and it looks the same, it's a different configuration, but it's equivalent. So you don't count that as a new configuration. You factor it out. So this is the part that is symmetrically equivalent. And this is the crucial part. And this is the part that we call the space of true degrees of gravitational freedom. And what does this part do? It preserves the constraints, but it's perpendicular to the trivial symmetrical changes. So each point in this space represents an isometry class of space times that satisfy Einstein's empty space equations. So this is how the adjoint formulation gave rise to a splitting like this, a symplectic splitting, which turns out to be more or less a universal symplectic splitting. And this piece also, in a more general setting, is instead of being the space of 2 degrees of freedom, is actually the tangent space of the reduced symplectic manifold when you have a group acting on a symplectic manifold. And then you do Marsden-Weinstein reduction, you take its tangent space, you end up with exactly this middle piece. So this was done in the 70s when Jerry and Alan were working on this. This worked out to be a great example of Marsden-Weinstein reduction. Okay, so let me move on here to Riemannian geometry. Okay, so another theme that keeps coming up was the structure of various subspaces in the space of Riemannian metrics. So the first space we actually considered was if you take a given function on a manifold and you look at all metrics which have whose scalar curvature is equal to that given function, what is the structure of that space? So let's do this example here with M minus 1, capital script M minus 1. So this is the space of all Riemannian metrics whose scalar curvature is minus 1. So the first thing to note is that Aubin has shown that there's no topological obstructions to this. So for whatever manifold, provided n is greater or equal to 3, this will be a non-empty subset. Then the next thing to note is that in most cases, except when this row, well, I'm just talking about this one particular case, which is in a way the most important case, so let me just leave it at that. When this row is equal to minus 1, this space will always be a smooth submanifold of the space of Riemannian metrics. Now, let me just mention about how one goes about proving that. Well, it's what I said before. You take the derivative of the scalar curvature function. You note that that turns out to be an elliptic operator. And so it's you have a splitting of symmetric two tensors into the kernel of that and the range of the adjoint. So in order to show something as a smooth submanifold, you want to show that that it's the inverse image of a submersion. Now, why is this a submersion? Well, it was simple. All you have to do is analyze the range of the derivative of the adjoint. If that is zero, then this thing is going to be onto. So what we did was just looked at the cases when we had a machine. We could just look at when the scalar curvature is a surjective map. We had to do the splitting of the range space, so it's sort of looking a little backwards here. But we just looked at the kernel of the derivative of the adjoint. When that was zero, DRG was a surjective map, and we were able to prove that in a neighborhood of those metrics, the scalar curvature map was a submersion. Now, that's a good observation. That proves that M minus 1 is a submanifold. It also proves, actually, there's a paper by Jerry Kasdan about using this method to get a big chunk of their results on when scalar curvature functions are, when a given function is the scalar curvature of some metric. So this turned out to have a lot of practical importance. There's another tantalizing factoid that comes about because of this. In certain cases, with certain topological types, which we call Yamabe type minus 1, what that means is that if you look at the metrics which have constant scalar curvature on M, we want manifolds such that the only constant scalar curvatures have to be negative. It can't be zero, it can't be positive. In other words, we want to rule out things like spheres and tori, things of that nature. We want things that are, quote, hyperbolic, so to speak. That turns out, fortunately, to be most manifolds, actually. There's still an infinite number of spherical space forms, for example, but in some sense of counting, most manifolds are hyperbolic. Curiously enough, the M-1 turns out, if you take any metric on a Yamabe-type -1 manifold, you can conformally deform it pointwise to give a scalar curvature of M-1. So what that means is that this space of conformal classes is actually isomorphic to M-1. Well, M over P is a contractible space. So you can get this sort of very interesting fact that with this topological restriction of Yamabe type -1, the space of all pointwise conformal classes is contractible. So, I mean, that was another application that came out of that. Another application, there were quite a few applications, actually. Another application was work done by Tony Tromber and myself, where we used the space M-1 to look at Teichmuller space. Good, sort of here. If you take M-1 and divide by diffeomorphisms isotopic to the identity, then you get actually, and this is for two dimensions, then you end up with just the Teichmuller space of that manifold. This is provided that the genus P is greater or equal to 1. Okay, so there were some other applications. Let me just show you those also. I have to bring up another slide here. Okay. Now, another application of this, this was a result in Riemannian geometry. So this is an example of how results in relativity led to results in Riemannian geometry, and then results in Riemannian geometry fed back into results in Riemannian, into general relativity. Later, Vince Moncrief and myself realized that M-1 was an important space in what we call conformal reduction of general relativity. And just in one or two words, the ADM action can be written in a reduced form, and I have to tell you what that reduced Hamiltonian is here. And it turns out, curiously enough, to be nothing more than the volume element of the physical metric. There's two metrics here. There's the conformal metric and the physical metric. And they're related. This is a complicated relation. It involves work by what's called the Lifnerovich-Choquet-Brouat conformal solution of the Hamiltonian, which was then sharpened by Jim York and Jim Eisenberg. So given any arbitrary metric with scalar curvature -1, given any arbitrary second-order density, symmetric density that's transverse and traceless, you can then find a solution to the Hamiltonian system using the Lifnerovich-Choquet-Brouat conformal method. I'm sorry? Yes. It's much more complicated. Maybe asymptotically flat. This is our active area of research. If you want to see the stuff that flowed out of this, Yvonne Choquet-Brouat has her 600-page Oxford volume, and she traces out a lot of the work and everyone else's work, too. And it's a compendium of the interrelationships between scores of people working in this field. Okay. So let's see. So bottom line is we can now use the adjoint formulation using the reduced Hamiltonian. Now, what's the advantage of this? Well, here, there are no more constraints. The constraints are gone. They've been factored out, so to speak. And now, how is that possible? Well, it's all implicit, obviously. It's not really gone. They're just sort of, you say that you know the, if you want to get back to the physical pi and t, pi tt, you can do that. But of course, you have to solve nonlinear partial elliptic nonlinear partial differential equations. Nevertheless, these are the free variables. And this free variable gamma is in the space of Riemannian metrics of scalar curvature equal to minus 1. That's sort of the point, that this space of scalar curvature metrics of fixed scalar curvature actually is the configuration space for the reduced Hamiltonian Einstein equations. So that was another application that was part of the legacy with Jerry, of the hundreds of possible applications done by many other people. Another application that I like is what's called conformal Ricci flow equations. And here again, the application is that we're using the space of Riemannian metrics of scalar curvature minus 1. Now, of course, as you know, Ricci curvature does not have any constraint other than perhaps you want to, the normalized Ricci curvature has volume constraint, where the volume has to be equal to 1. But that's not doesn't lead to any, that does change the equations, but it changes it in a different manner. Now, why would you want to constrain Ricci equations to lie in this manifold of metrics whose scalar curvature is minus 1? Well, the answer to that, there's two answers. The first answer is it's fun, and that's always usually probably the better answer. Because I said the second answer and no one liked it. So. But the second answer is the following. What is the actual purpose of Ricci flow? Ricci flow really was derived for one purpose. The purpose was to find Einstein metrics. Now, as you know, Einstein metrics always have constant scalar curvature. So why look in the whole space of Riemannian metrics, which is very big, if you know that what you want to find has constant scalar curvature? Why not look where you're looking to find it, in the space of constant scalar curvature minus 1? Here's an analogy. Suppose you're looking for somebody in Toronto, and you know they're at the Fields Institute. You don't search the whole city, you just search the Fields Institute. Same thing. Don't search where you don't have to search. So the other nice feature of this, and which relates to Jerry's work with David Eben, which we heard so scholarly about earlier this week, is that when you do conformal Ricci flow, there's this tantalizing function P that comes up. P is not a dynamical variable. P is a scalar, and it serves exactly as a Lagrange multiplier that enables one to maintain the constraint equation. So this is completely, and what I call P is the I call P the conformal pressure. And why do I call it the conformal pressure? Because it's what forces the unconstrained flow back into the constraint submanifold. And as we know in Jerry and David Eben's classical work, this is exactly what happens in Euler equations or Navier-Stokes equations. The P here is not a dynamical variable. It's a Lagrange multiplier that can actually be eliminated. In other words, P and this equation, the constraint equation, can be eliminated. One can solve for P in terms of the divergence and plug back into this equation. So this whole equation here can be written in terms of V itself. And the nice thing about conformal Ricci flow is that the exact same thing happens. One can eliminate the conformal pressure and the constraint, and this one evolution equation can be written in terms of an elliptic part that just forces this constraint to be always preserved. The other remarkable thing about this, and David even brought this up, not about the informal Ricci flow, is that when you analyze the forces of constraint that force the solution to stay in the manifold of constant scale of curvature minus one, you see that the equations do not lose any more derivatives than if you let the equation not stay in there. And this is exactly the great discovery that David Eben and Jerry Morrison made for the Euler and Navier-Stokes equations. They do not lose derivatives when you make them incompressible and you restrict them to the volume-preserving diffeomorphisms of the underlying manifold. So there's something, well, I wouldn't say universal, but there's certainly a similarity going on here, which is not well understood, that somehow constraining under certain circumstances does not make the situation any worse than not constraining. So David pointed this out also, and I was sort of floored that he sort of ran into the same question. Okay, so now let me... Yes, Richard. Yes. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Is it the L2 projection? It might be a non-orthogonal projection. It certainly is a projection. Okay. We're sure about that. Let's say for the sake of argument for now that it is. Okay. Okay, so let me pull these up and just talk about some other features that, again, this is just to touch on the highlights of things that we did. Kind of a house lights, maybe, or something. And how do you get these up? Does anyone know? Yeah. This is a multimedia talk, or another way of putting it, I'm not fully prepared. Up. Make screen blank. No. Make. Okay. Well, Andrea said he'd be within 10 seconds yelling distance.
You want him
up. Okay. Cool. Cool. Okay, so let me just talk on some other themes. I don't know how many. I think I have 10 minutes left. Let's just briefly talk about linearization stability, which was also another main theme that just came up. That is, we weren't thinking, oh, what should we should talk about, find something about stability. Linearization stability, that sounds good. That isn't how it worked. We were talking about the constraint equations in relativity, and we noticed that there was something going on. And here's what was going on. First of all, let's just take some Banach manifolds, X and Y, take some map between them. Let's take a solution to that, a particular solution, and let's take a linearized solution around the given solution. Sorry. See it? You don't have X-ray vision? And now the question is, suppose you have a linearized solution. In relativity, that's exactly what you have. You had linearized solutions to Einstein's empty space equations. But actually, Brill discovered that on certain circumstances, that linearized solution did not actually have a full nonlinear solution underneath it that would be tangent to it. So in other words, I have a vector, but I don't have a curve underneath that vector. Well, you could say, how can that happen? Well, it happens because the subset of solutions does not form a submanifold. And so what is a vector in the tangent space to the ambient space doesn't have a submanifold of solutions underneath it. So linearization stability is, what is stability? Stability is when some property is preserved. So the property that's preserved is finding solutions in a given direction. suppose you have a solution to the infinitesimal equations, can you find a solution in that direction that a finite solution, that is a full nonlinear solution? If the equations at this point have this property, then they're said to be linearization stable at that point. Well, that was a term we coined. We didn't really, you know, think too much of it. And then we started looking into both relativity and into Riemannian geometry. And we started to analyze the maps from MS into HS minus 2 for S greater than N over 2 plus 1. And started to see whether or not this map at a given solution was linearization stable or not. And more importantly, we looked, sorry about that, for relativity for the appropriate space here, and to see if this was linearization stability. And we gave solutions for when they were, as I said before. If you had a G and a pi that had no simultaneous killing vector fields, so if the only solutions to this were the zero vector, then in fact this would be a manifold and the divergence constraint would be linearization stable. Similarly, the Hamiltonian had some given conditions, namely if pi were not the only case it's not is when pi is zero and g was flat. That's the only case when it would not be linearization stable. So we thought that was pretty good. And under those circumstances, we could prove that Einstein's equations were linearization stable. So what that would mean is if you take the empty space Einstein equations and you linearize it around a given solution, so this is an important thing that physicists do, because this is essentially the wave equation. Well, you want to be sure that you can actually find a full curve of solutions to any given linearized solution. So an important question was, are the Einstein equations linearization stable? Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So if there's no killing field, but it's flat, like kind of some skewed curve, is it still linearization
unstable? Okay, so... There's two equations here, unfortunately. The divergence constraint, del g... What's that? That's for this, and the Hamiltonian is the flat one. For the intersection. Yes. Okay? So we thought that was good. Then Jerry, so one afternoon I'm talking to Jerry, and he says, hey, Arthur, did you see Vince's paper? So I said, no, I didn't see Vince's paper. I just came in. So he said, well, Vince has found a way to do away with all of these conditions, and he has one space-time condition. So I said, that's good. Let me see Vince's paper. So we started poring over Vince's paper. Vince Moncrief had this incredible, brilliant unification that the answer is this. If there is no killing vector, this is the space, if you look at the evolved space-time, and if there is no killing vector field, so the only, except for the trivial one, then that metric is linearization stable. So all of these other conditions where you also have to require that the trace be constant, I mean, this was sort of all ad hoc. He pulled out of the hat this remarkable, profound conclusion that there should be, all you need is that there be no killing vector fields, and then it's linearization stable. And so what that means is that if you look at the space of, say, Ricci flat space times, which is Einstein's empty space field equation, that means that if you think about it, and here's why it actually makes sense. Normally, when does this space have singularities? This space has singularities when the metrics have symmetries, because you have this group acting. This already was noted by David Eben back in his thesis that if you look at the space of Riemannian metrics and then you look at the space of diffeomorphisms, that's not a non-singular quotient space. That's a singular quotient space. That this is called superspace. And actually, this is what I picked up in my thesis to show that, in fact, this can be stratified into manifolds. But the space itself is singular. So the incredible thing about Vince's Moncrief observation is that the singularities occur exactly where you expect them to, at the symmetrical space-times. So, wow, that really simplified everything, and that's a frequently quoted result, that you do have bona fide linearization stability if and only if the space-time has no killing vector fields. So tell me how I'm doing on time, or am I minus 10 minutes, or what? I could go on, or just not. Five's good. Okay, so let me just make another observation that we did, and this goes back to the work in nonlinear partial differential equations. Because even though I actually, we started this off, I think we had one or two papers about it. It just took off after. Jerry wrote some papers with Tom Hughes and Cato about quasi-linear first-order symmetric hyperbolic systems. I think it's even become a monograph, if not a book or two. So, I mean, but it all started with one observation. If you look at the Ricci equations in harmonic coordinates, you get this incredible observation, which was the observation of Choquet, Brouat, and Lifnarevich, that they can be put into this quasi-linear form. Namely, the second-order operator here acts the same way. Oops, I wanted to capture that too. Acts the same way on each component of G mu nu. And then using that observation, and then using some the results of Leray and Dion on strictly hyperbolic partial differential equations, which if you look at their original papers is very complicated estimates. I mean, it's done, but you can then basically just quote the fact that there is existence and uniqueness for Einstein's empty space field equations. And then Lifnarevich picked it up from there and wrote a whole book on Einstein's equations with matter. The observation we made was that if you set up a column vector like this, which has 50 components to it, and then you write this equation here with the suitable A0 and AJ, which are symmetric matrices, this is a first-order symmetric hyperbolic system. And then you can, if you sharpen the results for symmetric hyperbolic systems, which was not really that I mean, it involved some work, but it had nothing like the Leray papers. You can then prove, you get some very sharp result that for S greater than 3.5, you can actually, if you have HS initial data, you will get HS solutions. Or HF minus 1. And at that time, this was the sharpest result that was known. So this method was actually then picked up by Kleinemann and Rodniowski and even in Hawking and Ellis. I remember actually meeting Hawking once in Cambridge. And I was talking to him as much as I could, and he said, what's the best, can you get S down to 2.5? That was his comment to me. So I said, no, we're at 3.5. So he said, well, we get 2.5. So I said, congratulations. So that was good. But this was the first rigorous use of Sobolev spaces to get solutions to Einstein's equations. And it all came about by noting this one fact that the methods of Courant-Hilbert actually could be applied. And then let me just lastly say something else. Going back to the very first theme that we had here, that about the geometrization of the Hamiltonian form. These, the derivatives, these just fell into the whole notion of space and body coordinates for relativity. When you have a time-dependent metric on a manifold, so you can think of the manifold as actually rotating, just like for a rigid body when you have a total derivative or the space derivative, the partial, and then you have to take into account that the body is actually rotating when you take the total derivative. There's a time-dependent piece and the piece that comes from the body. This same thing happens in, as David Eben was talking about, well, he didn't write it explicitly, but the total Lagrangian derivative has two parts. One because the vector field is changing in time, and one because the vector field is moving. And the exact same thing happens in general relativity. The, where did it go? Did I erase something? Thank you. Good call. Well, why don't I just write it again? So this is the space derivative is the body derivative plus the convective term, so to speak. I'll take out the G, sorry. And this can be applied to any time-dependent vector field. So there's a component due to T, the fact that, I'm sorry, that's not a good view. Tensor. Mm-hmm. That's a tensor. And the observation here is that this is where this shift vector field comes in. If I now push forward or pull back, depending on how you take the sign of here, if I pull back by the flow of this time-dependent vector field, the tensor T, and call that T bar, these equations reduce to dt bar dt equal to zero, in this case, right? Well, there were some other terms, and I was just trying to neutralize the shift terms. But yes, plus other, it just becomes the other. So in other words, I do away, and what this is equivalent to, thank you, Darren, what this is equivalent to is jumping on the manifold, being carried away with it, going into, flowing along with the fluid. But the fact is that this worked even for Arnoit, Deser, and Misner formulation. So we observed that, and that also enabled us to simplify the pull away the shift vector field. And so what that actually ended up showing is that if you look at the constraint manifold of divergence-free vector fields, and you divide it by the diffeomorphism group, then, well, what is this? This is actually just the Marsden-Weinstein reduced phase space of the cotangent bundle of superspace, which is, as Wheeler knew, the configuration space for general relativity. So. And then the other theme is this isn't a manifold. This has singularities at the symmetrical G's and pi's. And those singularities are made worse by diffing out, by quotienting out by the diffeomorphism group. So all these themes were just wrapped up in this huge ball. I mean, it was really like this could have gone on forever and maybe will be by someone who gets, you know, interested and inspired by any of this. Okay. Thank you. I like to do that because then you get proper time here. See, the lapse, I mean, if the lapse is constant in space, yes. The problem is that the more general case, it's not. And that, I mean, that problem really has not been solved, no matter what anybody says. The problem is, can be reflected in, so here's the space-time. And so if it's not constant in space, if it's constant in space, you sort of have parallel foliation. If it's not constant in space, I mean, this picture goes back to, I mean, goes back a long time to what Wheeler called this many-fingered time. So you have what's called the Tominaga many-finger time, where you are free to push up on that surface in any way you want. Well, you can get singularities in the that are not really space-time singularities. They're sort of artificial singularities, for one thing. And which formalism works? I mean, this thing does, but this just takes into account the shift vector field. Oh, of course, the equations are still true, but you can't go see from one solution to another. So let me just make one comment here like that. I mean, if you look at the constraint space, so you have all those G's and pi's that satisfy the Hamiltonian divergence constraint. What's this squiggle? I want this to be true degrees of freedom. So let me tell you what squiggle is. You take a G and a pi, you evolve that into a space-time. So I have a space-time. And there's a degeneracy because the space-time isn't fixed. It can be pulled back by diffeomorphism. Now I take another G and pi in that space-time. So that gives me a new G and pi, G prime, pi prime. That is equivalent to this in the sense that they lie in the same space-time. So in here, I want it to be equivalent. So the thing is that in the dynamical formulation, the fact that one G pi is related to another one, that's bad. That means that they're really not different isometrically space-times. They're isometric space-times. In other words, had I started the evolution here and evolved maximally, I would have picked this one up. So they're equivalent, but they're equivalent in a trivial way. What I'm looking for is the sets of G's and pi's such that if they're different, they give non-isometric space-times. That problem is not solved. So I want an algorithm that gives me every G and pi in this bin, I pull it out. If I pull out two ones, I will get space-times which are not isometric. Whereas if I slice a given space-time, everything in it will evolve the same space-time or a diffeomorphism replica of it. So that's sort of the problem of true degrees of freedom. I want the G pi's that are truly give rise to non-isometric space-time. Yes, of course. Bypass it, you mean, or? Absolutely. All the black hole numerical people, all of GOLEM at a Max Planck Institute is working on similar things. Well, that has been used. They used the thing that has been most useful is the first order PDEs, the quasi-symmetric ones. Somehow that is very machine adaptable. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I missed the first part of it. Is what? Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, there's a little complication there because those don't really have compact hypersurfaces. So one actually has to analyze each one of those separately. Huh? Go ahead. Peter Diaz actually looked at the linearization stability of relativistic fluids and gives a set of conditions when that is the case, when they are linearizable, stable. But that's a good question, because and that ties in with what Richard was saying about the singularity issue. I mean, Schwarzschild, obviously the most fundamental of all solutions, is singular. So you have to, this this analysis doesn't actually work. So one has to look at that. And I'm not sure what's been done with that, in fact. That's certainly something I should look into and will. Thank you.
Right, we get, I think I set up to the